This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, although we are on remote. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and with me, Fleeta Brown, former Poet Laureate of the State of Delaware, award-winning poet, sweet voice. Fleeta, give us an opening poem.
Thank you, Grace. Okay, I'm going to give you an opening poem. I'm going to give you a poem that ends with a reference to Keats and When I Have Fears, that last line, to love and fame, to nothingness do sink. You'll only hear a little touch of that. Afternoons at the lake. I would rather be trapped in an attic with rats than play Monopoly all the afternoons it takes to lose the last of my money to the already super rich 1% grandchild, to lock cheap green houses on my low rent Baltic and Mediterranean avenues in a futile attempt to collect enough to survive the next round of rent on Boardwalk or Park Place, to feel pitiful gratitude when I receive for services $25. Everything will be gone, save the smallest denominations. The Asian crayfish will overrun the native. The autumn olive will proliferate. The tallest thing will grow taller, will be layered with gold, will turn to gold, will harden its gold heart. It will squander, jet, pocket, dole, win past wanting to win, dig the mine shaft, the ore, eat up the hillside, the birds, the whales, crack the foundations of houses, force the defaulters into the street. Dice will land as they will cause the tiny car to bounce happily from St. James Place to Indiana Avenue. A galaxy of gobble will enable the placement of flamboyant hotels on the coast, where waters wash with exquisite music shoreward, all of it owned by the God who dwells inside the winning, who has not said otherwise yet, who owns free parking and jail, who owns the treeless board, the classy neighborhoods, as well as the ones with the rats and smashed out windows, the murderous scrawl of languages on walls, the smiling God holding the center with top hat and cane. As I at last step out on the dock with my coffee and say to myself, the lines where Keats rhymes think with nothingness do sink.
The voice of Fleeta Brown, holding, what do you say about holding with top hat and cane? What's that line?
Yeah, the smiling God holding the center with top
hat. Holding the center, that's right, with top hat and cane. The great orchestrator. Okay, so this is like your 11th book?
10th or 11th, depending on how you want to look at it.
Yeah. Flying through a hole in the storm. Flying through a hole in the storm. And so I think you had two books come out together this year.
I do. I that's really a difficult thing because it's hard to manage two books at once. But, you know, you can't be choosers about these things.
I know. But it's better to have two than none.
You bet. That's just what I was going to say. The alternative is worse. The other one is called Mortality with Friends, and it's memoir essays, and it's coming out from Wayne State University Press in September.
When did Brief come out?
That actually was an original title of a book of poems, but I changed the title. I think this is it.
Oh, you're pretty sneaky, but I'm on to you. I'm on to you. Well, okay, so I've been reading your books. I read your memoir, Riding with Dvorak. I think I know who you are. I wonder if you know that there are themes in all of your books. And we are always having said that we write the same poem over and over, except for the words. So what's in this book? And what is the poem you're writing over and over?
Oh, the poem I'm writing over and over, I guess, is the poem of the lake, the poem of the tendency to lean too far in one direction and not pick up the other. I'm always trying to see both sides of things and to let all sides sort of come into the poem. Other than that, the poem of my family, I'm always writing. you know, I just can't get away from it.
Yes. And one of my favorite previous books of yours is when you were in love with Elvis Presley.
Yeah.
We knew you were one of the bad girls early on.
I was, yeah. I wasn't very bad, but I was that bad.
The thought, you held him in your thoughts. And at that time in history, that was a venial sin. Well, you're in Michigan now. Are you near the lake, the big lake?
Well, if I turned my computer, no, not the big lake. No, we are on a little lake in northern Michigan, a little bit farther north. And that's just our summer. That's where we are in the summer. In the winter, we're in Traverse City, which is on the bay of Lake Michigan.
Oh, okay. Are you the same Fleeta Brown that I knew in 1995?
Yes, indeed, unless I've changed into somebody else.
Okay, let's hear another poem and we'll evaluate that.
Okay. This poem I wrote when my father was staying in a nursing home. He sometimes felt really trapped in that situation and he needed to get out. And thank goodness this was before COVID and people could get out. So I took him for a ride along the bay. This poem is called Not Dying. He says he wakes and it feels momentarily like he's finally dying, a giving way, a sinking or hovering, can't say, but momentary, a window swung open you don't realize until a breeze. I take him for a ride along the tongue of land, west looking east, looking back at the city from a point, jet trails. He points them out, strung like necklaces, one fresh with its glint out front. We talk glaciers, how they stuttered and glinted down Michigan, pools for each pause, those excellent lapses, and branches bare because the trees are all dead, he says, forgetting the time of year. No, I say, dormant, road hum, ducks with their flawless wake. It hurts to turn his head. I slow and turn. Each new thing needs to be dead center, unencumbered. The names, mallard, jet trail, power island. Boat slips claim blank water breathing in their hollows. He says it feels like dying. He says it is if he had been lit up from the inside, a room waiting, a waiting room. Not an ordeal, but road hum and light. At night, the aides come by. One kisses him goodnight on the lips, he says. Where? The lips. He smiles as if he's gotten away with something. He's miles away, a faint, agreeable aftertaste, nothing he can describe.
The moment that you captured. Poets have a spiritual practice of noticing that moment that has to be made permanent. Now, you have written essays, prose, memoir, as well as poetry. How you're always telling a story. Fleeta Brown is always telling us a story. Now, how do you decide whether that story should be in prose or poetry?
Boy, that's a good question.
It really is.
Yeah, it's a good question for all of us, I guess. Mm-hmm. I think that if I find myself wanting to play with it more, then it turns into a poem. If the story is a little bit overwhelming and it pulls me along, then it probably is going to be prose. But if I just keep dwelling and turning and turning and turning on it, then it's probably going to be a poem. And I write more poems than I do prose, for sure.
Well, that is a very good explanation. That is really close to the gut. That is really about navigating, manipulating, and persuading those words to do something. Yeah, but give us another poem and we'll judge it.
Okay. This actually is a good segue because this is a prose poem. It's from a series of prose poems called treatises. These poems, this series called treatises, touches on my father's death over and over, but it's not really, I couldn't say it's really about that. Each treatise is about like a little mini essay. This one is called On Butterflies. I have not yet seen a butterfly this year. There are fewer and fewer. Yet I can send you one as a text message with many little blue ones in a row. King Midas in the Greek legend turned everything he touched to solid gold, which turned out to be not so good if you wanted a drink of water or if you longed for a real butterfly's airy flutter at the edge of your sight, if you longed for the spiritual world. It's good to remember that the spiritual world was first made out of chewed leaves, then suspended in a chrysalis like a dream for a great long while before it knew what it had become. That is like this grief since my father died. Who knows how long I will hang here, or if what comes next will be any improvement. Who said the butterfly is more spiritual than the worm anyway? Is it better to fly than to crawl? I have so many questions being stuck here as I am. It feels as if my father is fluttering at the edge of my sight, but that's the habit of my mind. No single butterfly completes a long migration. Sometimes it takes six generations. He was lying there, pale as a statue, which is the dying phase of living. Some people see a butterfly and think it is their beloved dead sending a message from beyond. When one phase is over, I think it is natural to start looking around to see what kind of outfit life is going to be wearing next.
Well, that's interesting because we have the long line length there, which is poetic because it's lyrical. Then the poem we heard before that was quatrains, four line stanzas. Then the poem we heard before that was, when you opened up, it was couplets. So you really refresh the page by using your craft, all edges of your craft, so that one is never bored from reading, you know, because each page will surprise you in its spacing, aesthetics. And I'm sure that much of that is unconscious. But I want to talk about that particular poem. First, did you start with an image? And here are my questions about that prose poem about the butterfly. So you had an image. Now, I would like you to burrow into that process. And did you just write from margin to margin? Did you discover what it was about as you went on? You certainly didn't know the ending in the beginning. So tell us about writing that.
Oh, I did probably have, I knew I was going to write something about a butterfly. That's about the best I can tell you. So I try really hard to follow where my mind is going, and it's really hard for me always to see where it's going, to see what it's doing. You know, sometimes my conceptual mind takes over and tries to push one way or another, but if I can just kind of stay with the image and see where it's going to go, or stay with my underneath mind and see where it's going to go, like I've not seen a butterfly yet this spring. There are fewer and fewer. Well, to that point, you know, it's just kind of reportage. But then I start in my mind, I'm thinking about the little blue emoji butterflies. And so that comes up. And then somehow I've thought about, okay, you know, the little blue butterflies. Then I don't know how I got to King Midas, except that things turn into other things. And so I think I just sort of keep moving.
And that's a good explanation, because what you do is many times insert popular culture into a greater fabric. And so your poetry can be seen as a cornerstone really of our time in history. Emoji, you know, that was not a common word for poets 10 years ago, was it? So I like the way, and your Monopoly game. So you always live in the moment, doing real things with real people. And pop culture gets in there. And I'm thinking all the way back to your love of music and rock and roll. Do you agree that you are guilty of this?
Guilty of using pop culture. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, indeed. I'm not very good at pop culture anymore because it's gotten beyond me. You know, I'm too old to catch. I don't know the current references very much, a lot of them. But I think everything, I dump everything in a poem. I think everything should be in the poem as long as it's there because it's natural, because it feels natural. You have to take the person who's speaking into account. And once you hear the voice, once the voice sort of sets it, it sets its own boundaries. And when you hear that voice, then from that point on, you need to feel that voice is writing within its own boundaries. And like, if I suddenly refer to something that doesn't sound like me, then that would be disruptive and feel artificial. It would feel like I was really straining. So I don't want to feel like I'm straining, but I want to feel like I've gotten sort of underneath my mind.
So it's really intuitive, and we can teach a lot, but we can't teach that. Let's hear another poem. This is the book. It once was called something else, but now it's Flying Through a Hole in the Storm. And that means a lot more than what it says.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm going to read that to the title poem right now. It wasn't the title poem, I have to say, but it was called Briefly. And then it was called the title of another poem here, which is The Goldilocks Zone. I called it that for a little while. And then it was chosen for the Summers Prize with that title. And then I looked up that title and I found that there was another book of poems with that title, Goldilocks Zone. So I said, no, I don't want to do that. So that's why it ended up being called Flying Through Hole in the Storm. So the poem is about flying through hole in the storm is started with a real event, which is sitting on an airplane waiting and waiting for the storm to release enough so we could get out of there. But then finally the pilot came on and he said, well, folks, I've seen a hole in the storm and I'm going to fly through the hole. And I thought, uh-oh. Anyway, flying through a hole in the storm. The plane shudders and shakes and lurches. Outside, lightning exposed, then buried by clouds. The lady next to you has a dying sister, and takeoff was long delayed. And you don't ask if it might be too late. You are thinking of the German plane crashed in the Alps by the co-pilot who wanted to die and take everyone with him. And you're thinking how living is always lit against the dark. And you think, there I go again, making metaphor, while the lady sits there, while lightning connects the plus at the top of the cloud with the minus at the bottom, as if the cloud were at war with itself, driving itself crazy, trying to reconcile. You have a sense of flying through space, which is funny because you always are, as surely as if you were St. Francis flapping your habit down the road, keeping nothing, giving away even what you need, smiling at the lack, the beautiful emptiness that allows birds to fly through, even through clouds, and allows for the forest to be clothed for its creatures, and you one of its creatures, with the kind of raw attention that can turn to the lady, shedding everything else. St. Francis and his monks are heading down the road, joyful and homeless. You feel the attraction of homelessness to those with homes, the wish to be free, to be weightless, but always as an in-between state, with a fire someplace, a hearth, a sister. Still, the mind doesn't shake it off. The plane not arriving, heaven not coming on earth, and what it must look like from out there at night, this lone vessel carrying on with its small lights.
Also, your tone is very colloquial, and you write like you talk. So it's not folksy, that you're not as folksy, even though the University of Nebraska put you out. You are very colloquial. And that is what wins, I think that's what wins people over about your writing. So you know that your voice is the everyday voice, right?
I do know that. And I am glad for that. That's what I want it to be. I get bored very quickly with poems that try really hard to be some voice that isn't the real voice.
And how long does it take us to get there?
Oh, Lord, like 30 years of meditation.
Really, truly, when I hear myself reading my first poems, I blush with shame for that person who didn't really exist, but was trying to. Also, I want to know, what do people do on airplanes if they don't write poetry? I mean, everything you do, everywhere you go, is a platform for you to write a poem. So let's hear another. More, please.
One more, please. Okay, this is the last one in the book. It's called Weeping Alaskan Cedar. And the book has been full of a lot of difficult things. And so this just immediately announced itself to me as the last poem in the book, as a way of sort of putting onto the cedar a lot of things. A Weeping Alaskan Cedar, by the way, has branches that it's kind of tall and skinny and scraggly. It looks really scraggly. That's why it's called Weeping Alaskan Cedar. The Weeping Alaskan Cedar looks like a starving child, its few shaggy clothes hanging. It is my favorite right now, a sister in the weeping world. They will ask, what was it like then? And I'll say that. I'll say it had a faint odor in passing, and no one else had stopped. I'll say there was so much evil, the word evil was hard to say, but that the cedar said it, an emptying which amounted to the same thing. It said it would wait and that it would cast a small shadow in the meantime. It said it would be quiet as long as it takes.
There, that proves my theory. That last line, you go into a familiar phrase, as long as it takes, and you bring it home as if it's the most comfortable place that line can be. So the colloquial is as elevated as I ever want to be, and you've got it going on. Before we hear a final poem, we do have time for poems. Poets always ask, do I have enough time? That always amused me so much because politicians never ask that. But you are busy in Michigan. So you have a column and a radio show. Tell us a little bit about each.
Well, I have a column. It's just miraculous, actually, that this town of Traverse City, which is not very big, has a newspaper, which is pretty darn good. And they give me as much space as I want once a month to publish a poem, not my own, I use other people's poems, to publish a poem and talk about it. And I use that as kind of like, as if I were still teaching Poetry 101 at the university. You know, I use it as a way to get into, to show people how to get into a poem. And not in a superior way, but just kind of this is us being readers, and this is how we can hear the poem and how I hear the poem. And I you know, 600 or 700 words about the poem every month, which is miraculous and wonderful. And then the radio show is Michigan Writers on the Air. We are kind of irregular with when that comes out, but my friend Aaron Stander runs the show, and he interviews people about their books, and I have 10 minutes at the end as a commentary on somebody's book of poems.
Finally, before our final poem, how do you miss teaching after 27 years in Delaware, the university? I mean, now that you're away and you've backed off and you look at that life, what do you think they'll remember about you?
Oh, good question. I don't know. Occasionally I hear from a student saying how much they remember and enjoyed my classes. So, and of course, you know, I also taught for 15 years in a low residency program in the Rainier Writing Workshop in Tacoma. That's a low residency, so it's not a full-time thing. And I just retired from that last year. So
that was my MFA, right?
An MFA program.
Yeah,
yes.
Graduate level. So yeah. You don't think... Well, if you don't know what people are thinking about you all these years later, can you tell me what you hoped you left with them about poetry?
Well, probably what every other poet would say. I just want people to find a few poems that have some meaning for them and that somehow make their life feel more rich and more, maybe even more heard, you know, because if I find a good poem by somebody else, I think, oh, yes, that's right. And that it validates me. And it also gives me a new way to think about the world. And so, you know, I hope that people read my poems.
So you say a good poem is when people read it and say, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. Or that's right. I don't mean that as in it validates their own prejudices. I mean, that's right as in, oh, my goodness, yes, I see that now, or I see that from a different perspective.
That's the title of your next book. I see that now.
Okay.
Because we know you have one started.
Well, yeah.
Of course. Admit it. And a final poem. I have to tell them some things about you, though. You've had like 10 or 11, she can't remember, poems, books of poems. And then she's won the Hollis Summers Prize from Ohio University Press. And she's got a book called The Woods Are on Fire, New and Selected Poems from the University of Nebraska, Charmed by Ted Kooser, former U.S. Poet Laureate. Has a collection of essays, her memoir, Driving with Dvorak, which I've given to people to teach them how to write a memoir.
Oh,
and she has won too many awards. She should give me some. And now,
you have all you want.
Thank you. They don't keep you warm in the middle of the night, do they? Flee to my friend. Let's have a final poem.
All right. I'm going to read you a poem from almost the end of the book, and it's called History is Not a Great Tree. I was thinking about how we usually just put, you know, like on Ancestry.com, you know, how you trace your ancestry so that, and it looks like a tree. And I was thinking, no, wait a minute. Doesn't work like that. Not really. History is not a great tree. It's more like a bush, I think, or maybe a sponge, soaking up and periodically wringing out. Wow, a tree would mean you could get to the top, to the upper branches that would weave from your weight. It would be broad from there and still. You could see dis-ease roll across like wind over wheat, the way you see a tenement from the wide glass of your penthouse. You could imagine yourself down there, sleeping in your unwashed clothes, breathing the factory fumes, eating what's available at 7-Eleven. You could almost imagine dying just from living, growing fatter in the process. No wonder the germs love people. No wonder the germs are joining hands as if they were playing Red Rover. History would be branching and tangling and translating down there. It would be growing improbable and efficient. It might come by air. It could show up either as the time that was or the beginning, an annunciation, a trumpet you didn't know you heard until you did.
A trumpet you did not know you heard until you did, the voice of Leta Brown. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family and the Sinipid Fund. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and our engineer is Mike Turpin.